According to a Time magazine article, a 2019 article written by an author named Megan McCluskey, entitled, "Here's What Happened to All Those Bob Ross Paintings." Bob Ross painted approximately 1,143 paintings, three of the same painting per episode for his program, The Joy of Painting. There's probably not many people in North America that haven't seen at least one episode of The Joy of Painting. I've watched, well, I don't know how many episodes I've watched. I may have watched all of them for all I know, but I've probably watched hundreds of hours of Bob Ross from the time I was a kid. And up until now, they're still playing today. If you ever watch the program, or if you've ever tried to paint anything, something I'm not good at all, you learn a few things about his style of painting. You learn that paintings are made in layers. Paintings like his, at least, are made in layers. In fact, he usually says something that for a long time I had no idea what he was talking about. In fact, there was a number of things that he would say that I didn't understand, like alizarin crimson, and like, what are you talking about? What is this? When I was a kid. But he will often say, as he's starting out with the painting, he'll say, "Now I've already got a coat of gesso on the canvas." Well, I didn't know what gesso was either, but the long and short of that is it's primer that helps the paint bond to it. So he'll start with the gesso or whatever background color. Sometimes he starts with a really dark canvas and works his way out from there. And then you know how it goes. He starts applying layers of color. He's usually working on the sky, and then he'll sort of work on a horizon line, and then he'll work on a focal point with light. And then after that, he starts moving a little closer into our view, and he starts adding maybe some mountains. He did a lot of mountains. Clouds, maybe a line of trees for a forest, something like that. And then he'll start working a little closer, stuff with a little more detail. Maybe there's a lake, and it turns into a stream that often has a waterfall with rocks in it. And then he'll usually put a tree on this side, and then he'll say, but that tree has to have a little friend. And so he'll add another tree, and maybe another tree onto that. And he starts building and building and building further down into the foreground until the painting has almost, before your eyes, enveloped you. You're in it. You're standing right in the center of what's happening. And it all started with this far distant just patch of colors. And so it kind of goes from further to nearer, from more abstract to more detail. And I got to thinking about that for whatever reason, because we all think of random things all the time, right? Like I do. I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about how it relates to the book of Genesis. Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 in particular. Now, it relates not only to that, but I think it relates to all of God's handiwork, generally speaking, because God indeed is an architect, but he's also an artist. God certainly paints the creation beautifully. We go out maybe at sunrise or at dusk and we see a beautiful sunrise and we see God's handiwork. Well, Bob Ross was just trying to capture something of what God is painting all the time for us. And then at the end of the paintings, of course, Bob Ross would usually take red, sometimes not red, but a lot of the time it was red. And he would dip a really fine brush into the red paint. And he would go down to the bottom corner. You might remember how he wrote his name. The R would have a big scoop underneath that would underline the O and then the S and the S. He would sign that painting. But I think there's a parallel there as well. This is what God has done in the creation, in the painting of the world. And we see it in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. So I want to think about that with you, and then I want to develop Just a little thought with you about the scheme of redemption related to all of that as well. So first, let's think about the preparation of God's canvas. Let's think about how God painted the picture for us in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the water. This is quite abstract. There's not a lot of detail here. Genesis 1:1 is not a detailed account of creation. Genesis 1:1 is sort of the preparation of the canvas. It's like the gesso on the canvas. It's the primer. This is what we're going to be talking about, the creation of everything. We might say, maybe to a more modern way of looking at it, this is low-resolution stuff. It's not that there's not detail to be found within it, but Genesis 1:1 and 2 is pretty low-resolution. It's pretty abstract. God created the heavens and the earth. What does that even mean? We don't know until we keep reading on. Interestingly, in Genesis chapter 1, as we think of it as a whole, even the language there that is used to describe God's creative activity, and this isn't something that really comes across as much in English, although some translations will reflect this, even the terminology that is used to describe God's creative work, that God created, that He spoke, and that it was created, these are very basic general terms. Then at the end of Genesis chapter 1, there is a hint that more detail might be to come. After all the days of creation have been laid out, and again, these are very general terms. The painting that God is painting for us in Genesis 1 is pretty vague. It kind of gives all the major categories of things, but otherwise it's fairly vague. But at the end of chapter 1, there's a little more detail with a hint of a little more detail to come. In chapter 26, God says, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." Well, there's a lot of richness and depth there. And we find out when we sort of turn the page and go to chapter 2 that God is actually going to detail that creation quite a bit. There are a number of people that have argued or have criticized that Genesis chapter 2 is a whole separate creation account. No, it's not. Genesis chapter 2 is a more focused and precise account of what happened in Genesis chapter 1. They're both records of the same thing with different magnification. We're getting closer and closer to God's objective in chapter 2. But the hint of it is here in Genesis 1. Let us make man. I think the way that we should read that, the way that we should think about that, let us make man in our image and after our likeness, should be something like this. Let us make this particular creature, as opposed to everything else that we have already made. Let's make this particular creature in our image and after our likeness. You know, there's a sense in which the whole creation bears the imprint of God. The heavens do declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. And there's nowhere, the psalmist said, that their voice is not heard. So there's a sense in which the creation does reveal to us God. But there's a special imprint on one special creation, and that is mankind. We bear the imprint of God. So now we see some things starting to come a little closer in the foreground of the picture. And then in Genesis chapter 2, we really get more details of the creation itself. In Genesis chapter 2, we see God working with Adam, placing him in the garden, telling him to name the animals as he brings the animals to him. The creation of woman takes place there. Marriage takes place there. The first home is initiated there. The command to fill the earth and to subdue it is there. Much more fine detail now about the creation of man, the creation of woman, the creation of the home, the creation of marriage, the creation of, or the instigation of what it is that man is to do and how he is to fill his time. Now we're getting more and more detail about creation. We find that man is not just another object of creation that does God's bidding. In fact, all of the creation does exactly what God created it to do. except those that bear his image. Isn't that interesting? But man is not just an object that God spoke into existence. The language of man's creation is actually more specific than the creation in Genesis 1, and it tells us a little bit more about it. Now we're talking about an intelligent being who is participating in the world with God. This is higher resolution. And even the language is higher resolution. The language goes from general terminology, chapter 1, verse 7, and so on, verse 1, to a more specific terminology about the creation of the man and the creation of the woman. In chapter 2 and verse 7, the scripture tells us that the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground. God fashioned man in a particular way. He didn't just say, "Let there be man," like he did with light and all the other creation, but rather he formed man of the dust of the ground. Furthermore, in chapter 2, in verse 22, when speaking of the creation of woman from a rib of Adam's side, the scripture says that he fashioned the woman. It's actually two words, one for the man, one for the woman. Both of them more descriptive than the creative terms in chapter 1. One word conveys the idea of a potter shaping clay. That's Adam, chapter 2, verse 7, man. Highlighting the skill and the care involved in the creative process. The other word for the woman conveys the idea of creating something stable and enduring. So in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2, we see God, the great artist, preparing the canvas and laying out sort of the further, more abstract things, and then working closer and closer to the finer details of his creation. The second thing I want to suggest to you is that God, there's always a reference for the painting. There's always a reference for the painting. Each element that you can watch when Bob Ross is making a painting has a reference point. Bob Ross has seen a mountain. If you have watched the show, you know that he served in the military and spent a good deal of that time, if not all of that time, in Alaska. I've never been to Alaska. I know some of you have been, but I've seen some of what is involved there. He's definitely seen some mountains. He's not just making things up as he goes along. There's a reference point for his painting. And maybe it wasn't hanging on the wall, but it was hanging in his mind. He had in mind what it was that he wanted to say or what it was that he wanted to convey. And so the Bible tells us that God also has a reference point for creating us. And that reference point for him was him. Him. God is the reference point for our creation. Now again, it's true that all of the creation in one sense beckons to God and references God. But we do that. Our creation does that in a special and unique way. God is pointing to himself with us. So, what exactly does that mean? Let us make man in our image and after our likeness. Well, I can't tell you that I have a specific answer. I'm not sure that the Bible reveals in a very specific way or maybe in one location exactly what that is to a degree of satisfaction that we might like. But I think we can think about it. We can probably draw some conclusions. We have a decent idea of what it can't mean. It can't mean that we're patterned after the physical image of God because God isn't physical. It can't mean that we are patterned after the deity of God because deity by nature is not created. So it certainly can't be that we're patterned after his deity. So what does it mean that we're created in the image of God? Opinions certainly abound. And there are some, I would imagine, that are better than others. What does it mean that God referenced himself in creating us, or that we are the reference to God? Some say that it is the fact that we have a will, that we have agency. That we have freedom, that we can choose. God certainly chooses. God certainly has a will. He certainly has agency. Some say that to be created in the image of God references morality, that we are moral. And God is moral. Now, obviously, humanity is not perfectly moral, but we're moral nonetheless. And so maybe it's a reference to morality. Some say that it is consciousness itself, being self-aware. Some say that it is our ability to communicate. Certainly God communicates, and we are patterned after that. And there are many other such things. Some lump all of that together and say that it is our spirit that is created in the image of God, because God is spirit, John 4:24. Now, the nature necessarily of that spirit has to in some ways be different, because we're not eternal. Now, we will be somewhere forever. We will live forever one way or another, whether that is connected to God or in the presence of God or separated from God. Surely I would hope this evening we're speaking to the majority of those who are going to be spending eternity connected to and in fellowship with God eternally. But we didn't always exist. So something of our spirit is different in that it came to be. But we are sharing spirit with God in that sense. It is life. The Bible tells us that the body without the spirit is dead. So the death of the body is when the spirit leaves the body. So the spirit is still alive in that sense. So I think that's reasonable, that it's our spiritual selves, whatever that means, what all ever that involves, that is the reference to God who is a spirit. But whatever that means, Genesis tells us that we weren't just created in some sense out of nothing as the rest of the creation, but we were created out of the creation by the delicate craftsmanship of God, fashioned into the image of God to dwell into this body. God created the body and then breathed into that body the breath of life. Now, the third thing that I want to share with you in reference to Bob Ross, of all things, is that the painter signs the painting. The painter signs the painting. God has left his impression on us, and certainly we have talked about that. But Peter says something interesting in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3. Peter says that we can become partakers of his nature. We become partakers of the divine nature. That's interesting. We can partake of the divine. We don't become divine, but we can partake of the divine nature. But God is divine. God is the craftsman. God is the artist, as it were. So he can't partake in the nature of what's on the canvas. We can partake in the divine nature, but he cannot partake in the human nature. Or can he? What does the Bible say? The Bible tells us a great number of things, but a passage that I've been pondering, and I preached on, I guess it was last week. I've been pondering on this passage quite a bit. Actually, Hebrews has just stuck in my brain since teaching Hebrews a few years ago, and it has really infiltrated every aspect of my study a lot the past few years, and I think about it a lot, and I think a lot about what is said in that great volume. And beginning in verse 6 of Hebrews chapter 2, the scripture says, but in a certain place, speaking of subjecting the world and unto the angels, he didn't put into subjection the world to come, but in a certain place he testified, saying, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? You've made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor, and did set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. This is a reference to creation, is it not? The way God created us. And you crowned him with glory and honor, and did set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we see not yet all things put under him. That's interesting. Did not God say in Genesis 1 that we referenced just a few moments ago that God put all of the creation in subjection to mankind? Did God not tell mankind, all of this is for you? You subdue it or subject it to yourself? Utilize it? He did. Over the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and all the creation. That's all that the Hebrews writer is saying here, that God subjected the entire creation to humanity. But he has an objection. And for a reason. He says, but now we see not all things are put under him. Why is that the case? Why is it the case that all things are not under man's feet? Now, we like to think that it's the case, but we sort of forfeited that. We sort of gave that up when we sinned. We gave up the position that God gave us. We forfeited that position. And the only way that we can gain it back, the Hebrews writer is going to show us, is through the perfect man. And so he says, God gave him everything, but now we see that he doesn't have everything, and he doesn't have it under control. But what do we see? Verse 9. But we do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels. What does that mean? He took on our nature. We do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, for the suffering of death. That was his mission. We see him crowned with glory and honor. That he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. For it became him. That is to say, it was becoming of him. It was right. For whom are all things? And by whom are all things? That's his deity. And bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. Now listen to verse 11. This is amazing. For both he who sanctifies and they who are sanctified are all of one. They're all the same. The one who sanctifies and the ones who are being sanctified are all the same. We share the same nature. Well, the artist can't climb into the canvas. The artist can only sign his name. How did God sign his name to the canvas? He went into it. He became part of it. We can share in deity. We can partake in the goodness of God and of his nature. But God fully took on our humanity in Jesus Christ. And then this part of the passage here, beginning in verse 12, you know, I hope you've read this before and have just been thrilled by what you might visualize in your mind here. But if you haven't done it before, do it with me for a moment. All right, in verse 11, he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified or are being sanctified are all of one. For which cause, this is why, he is not ashamed to call them, what? Brethren, brothers, family. He's not ashamed to call us family. Jesus is not ashamed to say, I'm one of you. Now, let's be clear about this. Jesus is not saying, I'm just one of you. Jesus would never just human. But in his humanity, he is indeed fully human. He's not ashamed to call us brethren. He's not ashamed to say, I'm like you. In verse 12, saying, I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the church or the assembly will I sing praise unto thee. Now, I want to ask you a question about verse 12 that you can think about if you haven't pondered before. When did Jesus say this? You ever thought about that? I know it's an Old Testament reference. But just because it's an Old Testament reference doesn't mean, if I can say it this way, that Jesus said it in the Old Testament. I don't think so. I believe that what we're looking at in verse 12 is the pre-incarnate, pre-creation conversation between the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Jesus says, I will declare your name unto my brothers and sisters. And in the midst of the assembly, I will sing praise to you. When will you do that, Jesus? When I go there. When I walk among them. When I enter into the canvas that I have painted. I will be one of them. And I will praise you with them just like they do. And again in verse 13, I will put my trust in him. It's interesting. Jesus could have put his trust in himself, couldn't he? Of course he could. But he chose not to do that. Where did Jesus put his trust? Remember this when you read, and it's hard because in the gospel accounts, we're always getting the humanity and the deity of Jesus at all times. It's impossible to divorce them. Sometimes one appears more prominent than the other. You appear to be getting the humanity of Jesus. But, you know, it's like a coin. Just because you're only looking at that face of the coin at that time doesn't mean the back of the coin doesn't have anything on it. It's still there. So one face may be forward to us in the account. And the human side of Jesus that was face forward to real human beings on this planet and that is face forward to us often in the gospel accounts is so human, is so identical to us that people didn't have to believe him. His own family didn't have to believe him. His brothers didn't. If Jesus' deity was so loud, if it made so much noise, like the confabulations of the second and third century accounts of, they're called the infancy narratives of Jesus, that Jesus was going around from the time he was a little boy, turning rocks into pigeons, striking people blind, and striking people dead. If Jesus was that non-human on a regular basis, you wouldn't have had a passage like Isaiah 53:3, which says, which is a complaint. It's the foretelling complaint of the prophet centuries in advance of why Jesus would be rejected, at least in part, which is this. He has no form or beauty that we should desire him. You know, that wouldn't be true if Jesus just went around like Harry Potter going, bzz, 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 you know, zapping everything in and out of existence and, you know, waving a magic wand. Because had he done those kinds of things and had he been that kind of person, such a rejection wouldn't have existed. He would have, you know, tickled everybody's fancy in one way or another. Well, this has got to be the guy. The reason why it was, not the only reason, but one of the reasons, probably a large reason why Jesus could be rejected is that he appeared, acted in most manners, most time, most of his life, like an ordinary human being. By the time Jesus was 12 years old, he had lived about 4,000 days on this earth. And his parents, when they found him in the temple, they said, "Oh, Jesus, there you go again, doing that thing that you do. We knew you'd be here because you're always talking and arguing with the doctors of the law and performing miracles and doing crazy stuff. And here you are doing more crazy stuff." Now, every day for them was just a whirlwind, wasn't it? Jesus does another crazy thing. We just get tired of it. No, they were shocked. How many of those 4,000 days do you think Jesus acted weird? He acted unweird enough for that occasion when he was 12 years old to be strange to them. And they reacted like normal parents would react. "Son, why have you done this to us? We've been worried sick about you." That sounds to me like this is not typical for us. Perhaps that's why it's there in the record. So when Jesus says, "I'm going to go and I'm going to take on their nature," I think what we have here in verses 12 and 13 is the pre-incarnate eternal conversation between the Father and the Son, and the Son is saying, I'm going to go do it. I'll declare your name. I'll sing in the midst of the congregation. I'll put my trust in you. And then this last one, I don't know. It makes me laugh. It makes me smile. Look, me and the children God gave me. I can just imagine what it must have been like for the divinity of Christ to be locked in a human body with its limitations and having the thought, well, look at this. Look at where I am. Here I am right where I said I would be, in the midst of my people. These are my people. I don't know, it just makes me smile. This is the painter not merely signing the painting, but getting into the painting itself. In Colossians 1, we see the eternal Christ prior to the creation was read a moment ago, that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. He really is the imprint of the invisible God. He is the real pattern of humanity, both before conceptually, not literally, but conceptually, the idea of what a human being is. Where did that come from? It came from him. Where did human nature come from? He invented it, not only for you, but for himself, such that he would occupy it at some point. He is the imprint of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rules or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before everything, and in him all things are held together. Jesus created all of it so that he could enter into it. And then his last statement in Revelation 22 confirms once again, this is who I am, the glorified Christ who has been, who always was, who lived, who died, who was raised again and lives forevermore. He says in Revelation 22, I am the Alpha and the Omega. The first and the last, the beginning and the end. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. Listen, I am the root and the descendant of David. The Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last. I started it, I'll finish it. So Bob Ross signed each painting so it would bear his mark to show he was responsible for having made this painting. He started it. He finished it. But Jesus started this painting. And he will finish this painting. He is the focal point. He is the light source of this painting. He even drew himself into it. The whole of creation, and especially humankind, is a self-reference by Jesus, for Jesus, for our salvation, to the glory of God. Christ's signature in this world is his very existence, the fact that he has been, the fact that he was promised in anticipation for thousands of years, and the fact that he has been. The world bears his mark, not just because he created it, but because he entered into it. And the mark, the impression that he has left, is inescapable. In fact, Ernest Renan famously said, Jesus is in every respect unique, and nothing can be compared with him. All history is incomprehensible without Jesus Christ. And what a joy and what a privilege it is to be a part of that great creation. What a joy and a privilege it is that he shares our nature with us, such that he's sympathetic toward us and intercedes for us, so that we can fulfill the purpose for which we were created, which was to spend eternity in fellowship with God. That is our purpose. That is our all. Our all is to be in fellowship with God forever, and only by Jesus is that possible. And it was only ever going to be that way. Only through Jesus could beings of free will, beings bearing the mark of God, but themselves not being deity, be in fellowship with God. It would have to be a matter of choosing. And we've had the fortunate privilege, most of us, I think, of hearing the word of God, believing it, confessing our faith in Jesus. choosing to put on Christ in baptism so that we can walk with him forever. But maybe there's someone here tonight who has yet to make that choice. We hope that you'll think seriously about what all Jesus has done for you and know how much and how well he has loved you and loves you still. And if you've never obeyed the gospel, we hope that you would think about that tonight, perhaps do that. And if you're a child of God, you need to come back home to him. Something needs to be made right with him. If we can encourage you, if we can pray for you, we hope that you'd let us know as we stand and as we sing.